the pretty girl dancing to jug band music and a mess of mama's barbecue.
Barbecue, it's my spirit, I swear that it never fails.
What did you say? Did you say
with the pretty girl dancing to jug band music and
a mess of mama's barbecue?
Oh my god, they're so cute.
Oh, that is glorious there, Race.
1:40.
Okay.
Sounding good there, Race.
I heard this noise and I looked outside and there was a pretty girl dancing to jug band music.
I thought it would have been
news from the front.
It's most definitely newsworthy in the front. Here we go. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hello on Z.
Is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grailian Bunker, welcome one and all once again to the Grailian Report. I am your host, Micah Hanks, glad to be spinning cosmogirally through space and time with you once again as we head off on our foray into the fringe via the marvels of KGRARadio.com. Glad to be in pocket with you. Fresh back in the saddle from archaeological expeditions and journeys throughout the southeast, and looking ahead as far as what we're going to be getting into tonight, all kinds of news and views, and also some discussion of hallucinations, entheogens, virtual reality, and paranormal studies at the Pentagon. All this and more awaits you as my ever-talented, ever-trustworthy, Semper Fi of a Guy co-host joins us, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing really good. Doing fabulous, in fact, and I hope everybody out there is good as well. Quick shout out to everybody there in the chat room tonight. Glad to see everybody as they are filing in, including the enigmatic Mr. Jason Pentrail, who joined me doing field research this week. Team 7A out there on the front lines, enjoying ourselves. James Walda was with us too. Good times indeed. So, looking forward to diving into stuff with all you guys. Hope everybody's doing well. Hope everyone survived Thanksgiving and had a wonderful time. If anyone had their thumb on top of Thanksgiving in the most professional way, the true aficionado of every season, Mr. Race Hobbo Hobbs back in Master Control. How are you tonight, Hobbo?
Hello, Graylians out there. I'm doing good. Micah, how are you? Are you turkey drunk, guys?
Not quite. Although, I won't lie. I was on the road most of the weekend, and I had to sneak a little of Mama's turkey along with me.
I indulged a bit myself.
Yeah.
Don't lie.
I figured you'd have had some barbecue on Thursday, Hobbs.
It's in my spirit. I swear it never fails.
Yeah, that's an idea, though. Why doesn't anybody do barbecued turkey on Thanksgiving? If you want to do one of those atypical Thanksgiving celebrations, that's the way you do it.
That's it. That's the way you do it. I had a smoked turkey and then an oven-baked turkey. And next year, we had two turkeys this year, but next year, I think I'm going to do a deep fried turkey and a smoked ham.
Now, I've heard of the deep fried turkey. I've enjoyed more often than I'm probably proud to admit the smoked turkey.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, but have you ever wondered how H.P. Lovecraft would have cooked a turkey?
I did. I wondered that last week.
Matt began to wonder just a little more than the rest of us, apparently, and dug this up. I'm going to read this recipe for you from McSweeney's.net. If he were to have cooked a turkey, how exactly H.P. Lovecraft might have done it? And I think that this calls for a bit of echo. This time of the year, all Kabbalists, demonologists, magicians, and the like share amongst their number one scrap of forbidden knowledge, that soaking a turkey overnight in a solution of salt and water ensures moist results. However, we've discovered two bits of lost lore that take your Thanksgiving to the next level. One,
A turkey may be so prepared and preserved that according to Artificius, Key of Wisdom, an ingenious man may raise the fine shape of homunculus out of its ashes at his pleasure. So he may, without any criminal necromancy, raise the shape of any dead ancestor for study and labor. And two, when you add aromatics to the brine, the resulting roast is also infused with a delicious, subtle character all of its own. Follow these ancient instructions to prepare a perfectly brined turkey for your next feast. Now, among the ingredients he lists are 7 quarts, that is 28 cups of water, 1 1/2 cups of essential salts of ancestor long dead, 6 bay leaves, 3 missing sailors from the Black Gulf of Tartarus, 2 tablespoons of whole black peppercorns, 1 tablespoon of fennel seeds, 3 gallons of sea froth harvested on the eve of Malbon, 1 teaspoon black or brown mustard seeds, 1 fresh whole turkey patted dry, 1 bottle of Riesling, 2 medium onions thinly sliced, 6 garlic cloves crushed, 1 bunch of fresh thyme, and, of course, blood.
Well, and what will you need to prepare such a feast? I believe he goes into this, right?
The tools and materials, dear boy, are as follows. You will require a stone altar, a 5-gallon brining container or cauldron will do, a large brining or oven roasting bag, a refrigerator, 1 to 3 mute servants for the dead sailor management, and then also a copper brazier. Now, this is not essential, but it will emit the coziest of lighting for a dinner with friends and family. One would make the brine first and foremost. One day before roasting the turkey, bring 1 quart of water, the essential salts of a long-dead ancestor, bay leaves, and spices to a simmer, stirring until your ancestor has dissolved. You let that cool for 5 minutes. You submerge the turkey. In order to minimize the cleanup for your mute servants, line a 5-gallon container with a large brining bag. Place the turkey in the bag. Add ancestor mixture, remaining water, sea froth, blood of the missing sailors from the Black Gulf of Tartarus, and other ingredients. You then tie the bag, refrigerate for 24 hours, and if the turkey is not completely submerged, the monstrous apparition of your dead ancestor may be misshapen, half-formed, and soft in the center. Finally, step 3, remove the roast. You remove the turkey from the brine 1 hour before you are ready to roast it and pat it dry inside and out. You let it stand for 1 hour before roasting it to your preferred specifications. Capture all the noxious fumes arising from the roast in standard pentagram or entrapment whilst chanting this simple invocation. Ograd, Aif, Gebel, E, Yogsothoth, Nignahai, Zwaw. This last step is necessary lest the shambling horror of your dead ancestor overpower you and assume your identity. And of course, just enjoy it above all things. But do remember that once you and while you are enjoying, to hail Cthulhu. And note, you must actually hail Cthulhu, else you will be thrown yourself into the black pit of the Elder and driven mad by the nameless horrors and unknowable Archaean secrets for all eternity. Now that, my friends, is definitely a recipe we're going to have to try next year for Thanksgiving.
Well, you know, turkey's common around Christmas as well, yeah. So I don't see why we couldn't do it then.
Matt, you're a genius. Boy, I believe the elder gods have blessed us. So come Christmas, if we come back slightly misshaken, not stirred, then you'll know why. Oh, goodness. You know, a lot of people were a little chilled over the weekend, but not cocktail chilled. No, it was as a result of something strange that appeared in the sky. There was video made of this also, taken by a passing motorist in New York, which appears to show a strange bright red light emerging behind the trees over a rural part of the state. Now, one of the cameramen can be heard asking whether it was the Northern Lights. I can tell you from looking at the video, this wasn't the Northern Lights. It looked more like something out of a Lovecraft story, in truth. But alien fanatics Blake and Brett Cousins from YouTube channel Third Phase of the Moon apparently posted a clip taken some 600 miles away in Ohio, and it appears to have shown the exact same thing. So the question is, what was the source of the eerie illumination seen in the night sky? He said, "We have a very clear photo of something amazing that just erupted over the sky. This isn't just a flash. This thing sustains its illumination." I said, "It's also going in and out like it's something that just blew and is holding it." Now, this sighting, which occurred on November 22nd, happened off and on for over 15 minutes. What exactly are these sky flashes? William R. Corliss used to write about these. And in fact, while we were down there doing our excavations and field work, the 7A team and I, including James Waldo, we were talking a bit about luminous phenomena in nature. And he said, Corliss wrote more about that than anybody that I think I've ever read. And I said, he sure did. And he talked about everything from aggressive ball lightning to, indeed, sky flashes. And these sky flashes are something very unusual, but having not seen one myself, there's plenty of video out there on the web that seems to show these things. They often appear like, well, again, the night sky, usually emanating from somewhere around the horizon, just lights up inexplicably, and sometimes stays lit for several minutes like this. And there are a variety of different kinds of sky flashes that can occur. Again, I highly recommend the geophysical anomalies work that Corliss did. Sometimes you can find his books online that are devoted just to geology, luminescent phenomena in nature, things like this. But if you get something like one of his source books, which is kind of a collection of a wide array of different kind of phenomena, there's less to be said about those, but enough for the person who's just getting into this, I think, and a lot to learn. So again, strange phenomena definitely occurs in nature. There are theories as to what may cause these sky flashes. Some people think that this may be some sort of a radiant kind of illuminative phenomena that occurs in the magnetosphere, or just something that occurs atmospherically in the sky. Some have said that if a meteor is streaking through the sky, especially if there's a cloud cover, it can cause illumination from behind. But that, again, if it's a meteor, only would illuminate the sky for a few minutes, not for 15 minutes like this eerie red light did. Now, from time to time, there are such things as power substations going on the fritz, and those can cause a lot of light too, but maybe not seen from several states away, as seems to have been the case here, because it was filmed over New York, but then a couple of guys over Ohio said that they saw it too. This definitely seems to sound more like some sort of an atmospheric phenomena. As to what exactly, I guess that remains to be seen.
Well, there's always the age-old explanation of swamp gas reflecting the light of Venus as well, right?
That's an all-time favorite of mine.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it could have been jug band music.
Jug band music, indeed. It could indeed be jug band music. I'll never rule that one out. Yeah. So all this discussion of Lovecraftian horror over the holidays here reminds me of something rather novel. Dolly the Sheep, the late Dolly, I should say, was in the news recently. The Dolly the Sheep, as we all know, made biotech history back in 1996, Gizmodo reports, when she became the first animal cloned from adult somatic cells. She lived to the ripe old age of 7, so she lived for 7 ages, which is young for sheep, leading scientists, of course, to speculate that her premature death, however, had something to do with her being a clone. But there's new research on this, and it now shows that actually wasn't the case. This whole story can be traced back, however, to a single conference abstract that made brief mention of osteoarthritis in Dolly's left knee, which appeared when she was just 5.5 years old. Now, sheep typically live to be about 10 or 12, so when Dolly died before the age of 7, scientists kind of figured that her premature death and those early onsets of arthritis and other conditions were somehow related to the cloning. And in fact, it was soon taken for granted that a consequence of cloning was an early grave. But this is something I'll note, folks. You'll kind of see this sort of thing mirrored in science fiction, too. Although they weren't exactly clones, the replicants in Blade Runner, again, they had a shortened lifespan, too. Although that might have been more by design than anything else. But this new research published in Scientific Reports now debunks those early suspicions, showing that Dolly's health complications were not the result of cloning at all. It was just worn-out joints, and they weren't even really anything out of the ordinary. Biologists, they said, started to suspect that this was the case last year following a study of 4 8-year-old ewes that produced the same clonal, or they were made from the same clonal line as Dolly. And the researchers uncovered evidence of mild osteoarthritis in 3 of those sheep and moderate osteoarthritis in 1. But examination of those animals known as Nottingham Dollies suggested these particular clones aged normally and that Dolly must have been some kind of anomaly. But the scientists weren't content to stop there. They said, our findings of last year appear to be at odds with the original concerns surrounding the nature and extent of osteoarthritis in Dolly, who was perceived to have aged prematurely. Now, this was said specifically by Kevin Sinclair, lead author of the new paper and professor of developmental biology at the University of Nottingham. And yet, he said, no formal comprehensive assessment of osteoarthritis in Dolly was ever undertaken. We therefore felt it necessary to set the record straight. Because no original clinical or radiographic records were kept of Dolly, the researchers had to perform a radiographic exam, sort of like an x-ray, on Dolly's skeleton. And that is kept in the collections of National Museums of Scotland and Edinburgh. Now, Sinclair's team also examined the bones belonging to Bonnie, that's Dolly's naturally conceived daughter, and Megan and Morag, the first two animals to be clones from differentiated cells, or what are called pluripotent stem cells. And those results showed that osteoarthritis was more severe in these older sheep compared to that of Dolly. And what's more, Dolly exhibited no obvious signs of osteoarthritis in her shoulder, carpal, or hock joints when she was 6 years old. So the overall distribution of arthritis in Dolly was similar to what's seen in cloned sheep aged 7 to 9. They said that the prevalence and distribution of that arthritis, as detected via radiographic scans, was similar to that observed in naturally conceived sheep and our healthy aged cloned sheep as well. So they concluded that the original concerns that cloning had caused early onset arthritis in Dolly was unfounded. She was purely an anomaly. Although then again, what's not anomalous about a clone? Pretty fascinating stuff. So Matt, you know, assistant Lauren was helping me put together a segment earlier, and she has contributed some wonderful stuff for this week's show in keeping with the discussion of animals and anomalies. Have you heard, for instance, about the stunning new tarantula found in Guyana's national park known as Kaitour?
I'm not. I'm so glad you brought this to my attention.
I didn't ask if you were the spider. I asked if you'd heard about it.
I said, you asked if I was aware. I said, I'm not aware.
Oh. Have you heard, for instance, about the stunning new tarantula?
You asked if I was aware. I said I'm not.
Have you heard? See, you know what I'm doing? He's like, yeah, well, okay, because, you know, I don't need any spindly legs. You might have a thing about, actually, I'm not afraid of spiders. We were down there in the woods, Jason Pintrail and I, we were digging in the dirt. I felt a little something tickling on my shoulder. I looked over, and there was the biggest tangerine orange, some variety of riding spider, I presume, but it was crawling on my arm, and I just said, young lady, please, look but don't touch. Now, this spider, though, is even more terrifying, although beautiful, with this beautiful azure blue. A previously unknown tarantula species has been discovered in the forest of Guyana in South America, and it's absolutely incredible. The arachnid is described as having an electric disco blue body and matching legs. Along with their new blue discovery, researchers also found 30 other new species, including 6 varieties of fish, 15 aquatic beetles, and 5 dragonflies. Lauren, I wonder if it scared you when you saw it. Do you find it scary? That's my question for you. I don't remember if spiders are your thing or not. Some people love spiders. Some people keep them as pets. Some people, if they see one and they try to catch it in a tissue and it disappears, they sell their house.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not going to say I'm that far gone. Those snakes maybe I'd go get a hotel for a couple days.
Yeah. Even though it was cooler weather down there in South Carolina over the weekend, I am always careful when I get out in the field. I tell you, after, Pintrail and I, we encountered in one of the swamps we were working one time. We were paddling. He didn't see it, but I did, clearly. And I was in the back of the canoe and paddling along. I looked to my left, and there was a water moccasin with its head resting right on the surface of the water. The rest of its body coiled up on the bank. The head, I'm sure, had to have been almost the size of my fist. It was the largest snake I've ever seen in the wild. That's right. And Lauren says, yes, kill them all. Oh, goodness. But brave as she is, she managed to put this story together for us. Now, a spokesperson for Global Wildlife Conservation said that Guyana is one of the world's most important countries for biodiversity conservation, with the second highest percentage of forest cover on Earth and high levels of biological diversity and species that are found nowhere else. The region is known to have huge value globally for conservation and shelters several species that are vulnerable or on the verge of extinction, including Tepuai swifts, Guyanan cock of the rock, white-lipped peccary, and the golden rocket frog. Boy, what a cavalcade of names. I have to say, we're going to talk more about some bizarre, in fact, some ridiculous names that Lauren assembled for us here in just a minute. But first, this is fascinating. The EV Nautilus mission recently sent its cameras about a mile deep into the waters off the coast of Socorro Island. They spotted a beautiful creature there, too. Maybe not quite electric shock disco blue, but it's the name that's most compelling about this creature. According to Fact Zoo, it's known as the vampire squid from hell. That's the actual translation of the squid's Latin name, Vampyriotuthis infernalis. Now, aside from its name, the vampire squid from hell has some other interesting, possibly infernal characteristics. It's a bit scary looking with its squat, puffy, zombie-ish body. Some are black with red eyes, although not all of them. The skin can also be reddish or pale, and it does not have vampire fangs, but does have a big white beak. But the most fascinating characteristic is that, like other cephalopods, the squid possesses light-producing organs all over the skin. They create complex, flashing displays like synchronized dancing lights. You could almost call it the Christmas squid. And each of these even alternates in color. Are you looking at it, Matt?
Yeah, this is gnarly.
He had to go find one. Yeah.
Wow.
They say that the speed and the direction of the light flashes even changes on the surface of its body. This is likely used to dazzle and confuse predators. Another interesting factoid is that this squid has the largest eyes relative to its body size of any animal. There you go. There's your vampire squid from hell. But if you think that that name is weird, or if you were a fan of what were the other ones that we read there? The Tepawai Swifts, Gyanan Cock of the Rock, White-Lipped Peccary and Golden Rocket, Rocket Frog.
Say that 10 times fast, Micah.
Well, you know me, I probably could. That's the beauty.
Just a bit of practice.
Here are a few others, though. Okay, Lauren did a great top 10. Matt, back in the old days, you used to do top 10s. Now we've got somebody else who's doing top 10s for Grayley in here. So first we've got the spiny lump sucker. A lumpy-looking sucker it is. The lump sucker uses modified pelvic fins that have evolved into adhesive discs to stick itself onto a surface like a rock. We have the pink fairy armadillo. Forget about unicorns. Although this creature would certainly almost qualify as being one. We have pink fairy armadillos. What about the raspberry crazy ant? It's definitely crazy. This invasive species is originally from South Africa, but it's slowly spreading across, oh yes, Texas and the Southeast. I may have seen some of these raspberry crazy ants down there while we were doing some field work over the weekend. Yeah, and if they were indeed one and the same, they were sure crazy. What about the satanic leaf-tailed gecko? Yeah. Here's another one, although this is not so crazy a name, but now that I'm thinking about it and the somewhat satanic inferred idea here, I mean, I'm thinking about the creature differently. It's the hellbender.
It's all in the eyes. It's all in the eyes here, as you see there.
Ah, yeah. You're right. Yeah, it is. Well, with a lot of these creatures, it seems to be in the eyes. No, the hellbender, again, hellbenders are large salamanders that we have around here. They can get to up to about 2 feet long. Which is funny because people often try to naysay and say, oh, there aren't any large salamanders. You know, there are stories of these 2 to 3 foot long salamanders over in the Trinity Alps. And people are like, that sounds like a wives' tale. No, look, if you've never seen a hellbender, they are in the French Broad River right here outside of Asheville, North Carolina, and they can get up to 2 feet in length. But I never thought much about the name hellbender, a creature so devilish it can bend hell. let's see, we've got the chicken turtle. The chicken turtle. Now, that one might be a favorite of mine because of its similarity to a song that I've always loved since childhood.
The chicken girl, the chicken girl, the chicken girl.
Sing it if you know it.
The chicken girl.
There you go. The red-lipped batfish is another one. And the goblin shark. Now, Lauren included a little note for me. She says, you need to Google this guy, Micah. But Lauren, you should know me well enough by now. I already know the goblin shark, and I know exactly why they call it the goblin shark. I mean, it's got like, it looks like Hoggle from Labyrinth.
Yeah, a bit, actually.
Yeah, it looks a lot like it. Another creature that's like that is the lumpfish, an all-time favorite.
Yeah.
It looks like a pumpkin that you drew a face on. Yeah, except it's like, you know, ghastly white. And finally, our last contender of the night, the screaming hairy armadillo. Now, the name alone, I wanted to hear what this creature sounded like when it screamed. I'm not trying to be like, you know, horrific or devilish myself in saying I want to hear this creature scream, but this is a natural activity for it, as the name would entail. And so I thought, are there recordings of the scream of the screaming hairy armadillo? And as I was about to go and look for it, I noticed that there was an audio file included as an attachment with the email with the show prep that Lauren sent. And here for your listening in entertainment and pleasure, we have a segment from the Today Show in which a screaming hairy armadillo made an appearance.
He's really cute. Check this guy out.
Yeah, see, he's that? Cute until he screeches.
So this guy, yeah, again, screaming hairy armadillo. And there we go. Wow. Can you take, this, on, can you take the battery out? No, you can't. But this is what he would do if a predator was trying to eat him. He would make this noise, and it would make the predator try to drop him. So
Al makes that noise every morning. So yeah. It's so his defense mechanism.
It's his defense mechanism. We're going to put him
and
back.
And the hair, wow. Do they normally
wow, it's just like Kathy Lee came back from vacation.
Now, yeah, that was great. Oh, boy. That was really, really good, Lauren. That was so good. In fact, that was so good that I got to get you one of these old Middle Theory sound bites in here.
Something special just for you.
Special just for you.
That's right. So, thank you. Thank you. We got a great team here at Team Graylian. If it gets any better, you know, I'm just not going to have to do any work at all. I'm just going to sit here and read the news. Oh, wait, yeah, that's kind of what I've been doing.
See, Michael, we've been behind these microphones for, what, 8 years now?
Yeah.
And I feel like we have reached the pinnacle of our career now that we've played Wesley Willis live on the Graylin Report.
And the screaming hairy armadillo. It changed my entire life. Look, reading the news, even if somebody else is helping me assemble and write these stories, Matt, is harder than it looks, and hence why I have to don my eye gear here. Because staring at a computer screen can harm, and this is no joke, I'm not just saying that. A few years ago, well, I started picking up some additional editing work on the side along with my normal writing routine, and so I was spending even more time staring at the computer screen. And I'm pretty sure I caused at least some lasting damage to my eyes doing so, and I realized at that point, I said, okay, enough is enough. And in addition to going to the eye doctor and all this kind of stuff, it was recommended to me. They said, you know, your vision is good. You don't really need glasses. What you need to do is you need to start wearing some protective non-prescription lenses that will block that blue light coming from your screen. Now, I've tried a lot of different varieties over the years, but there is one that I've found that truly takes the cake in terms of not only their design, but also their appearance, because they look good when you wear them too. You probably have guessed I'm talking about Felix Gray. And one of the best things about Felix Gray's lenses is that they are especially designed to filter blue light and eliminate glare from screens like my Retina display. I could call it the Retina burning display on my MacBook. Now, these are the two main culprits behind digital eye strain. But with your glasses from Felix Gray, that blue light filtering technology, it doesn't come along as a coating on the actual glass that they use. No, it's built into the lens so that they remain effective without the telltale yellow tint or color distortion of other blue light filtering glasses. I'm wearing mine right now. Everything is properly proportioned in the color that it was intended to be seen in. But Felix Gray's frames are handcrafted from premium Italian acetate, and that's part of the reason this stuff works so well. This is the same stuff, in fact, that Versace uses. In other words, they look great. But remember, you don't have to have a prescription to wear these glasses. And in fact, like I said, if you spend a lot of time staring at a computer screen, wearing protective non-prescription lenses might actually help you keep your eyes healthy and preserve your vision. Now, I asked them specifically, do they offer prescription glasses too? And as they have told me, soon they hope to add that to their catalog too. All the more reason I think you need to head over there and take a look at the website, which I'll tell you about in a moment. Again, I got to tell you first about the pair I decided to wear, which when you go to their site, you're going to see they're called the Faraday style. The names alone, I mean, they had me from the names of brilliant minds of the last few hundred years. And of course, name for some of these bright minds who would have, had they known that this kind of technology existed, they probably would have benefited as well. And there's an entire array of great classic designs to choose from there at the site. But remember, too, all the orders are free shipping with free returns, and so you really have nothing to lose except that annoying eye strain. So give your eyes the break they deserve. Head over to felixgrayglasses.com/TGR, as in the Graylin Report, and you can try a pair of Felix Gray computer glasses today and discover a smarter way to work. That's felixgrayglasses.com/TGR, felixgrayglasses.com/TGR. You will not regret it. In fact, I think you might love them. I know I do. Now, when we come back from this break, I want to talk a little bit about the fella who has decided to build a rocket and launch himself into space with one thing in mind. If he goes into space, he'll be better able to determine whether the Earth is flat. This and other news of private space exploration when we return here on the Graylin Report. Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time around the globe via KGRARadio.com. It is the Graylin Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, coming to you live and loud, proud as always to be your light here in the darkness as we broadcast from a clandestine location deep below ground. Now, I'll tell you, from deep below ground, you can learn a lot of things, but of course, what I miss the most is seeing the sky, Matt. And that's why I'm very intrigued by what Mike Hughes, otherwise known as Mad Mike, what he's saying he's planning to do. I understand it's not exactly easy. There's certain laws and regulations that are making his attempt to fly into the air with a homemade rocket and determine whether the Earth is flat. Yeah, he's kind of hit some hurdles, I think.
Yeah, well, he was supposed to launch Saturday, allegedly, but there were some rules and regulations he was not abiding by, so he's moving the whole operation about 3 miles down the road, and they should take off tomorrow morning.
So he is planning to take off
tomorrow? He's still planning on taking off, yeah.
Oh, wow. NPR reported on this, and everybody else, too. He is a limousine driver, a self-proclaimed flat earther. He announced that he had...
And a stuntman. Don't forget that.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of a Super Dave Osborne type. Yeah, an Evel Knievel, if you know what I mean. Now, the launch, again, which was billed by him as a crucial first step toward ultimately photographing our disc world from space, was, like Matt said, rescheduled. But apparently, the Bureau of Land Management had gotten wind of that plan, and then they barred him from using public land in Amboy, California. According to the Washington Post, state officials have thrown a few obstacles in his way. The Bureau of Land Management was one of them that we mentioned, of course. But he said that apparently there was some kind of verbal permission to hold the rocket launch on public lands. Well, you always know that you're in good shape if you got verbal permission.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. You mind if I launch a rocket to try and prove if the Earth's flat? Sure, buddy.
Dude, he could do it in my backyard. I would let him tomorrow.
Well, again, Hughes has actually... When I first heard a guy was building a rocket to prove that the Earth was flat, I was like, okay, this is gold. Now, Hughes has actually flown in this rocket before or in similar ones of his design. This is not the first time he's done this. He actually knows what he's doing and has filmed it. There is video online of one of the launches, but he was flying through the air and then, of course, jettisons in various parachutes, which to me sounds incredibly dangerous, not just for him, but, I mean, where does the rocket land? What goes up must come down. He parachutes to safety, but where does the rocket go down?
Yeah.
I hope he's doing these tests over the desert or something.
Well, I saw a post the other day by our good friend Nick Iannello, and he was so on point. He said he should maybe try believing a little bit in physics so he doesn't die. Although I think the well-versed in physics are kind of set in their ways about the whole round Earth thing.
And with good reason, as we've discussed many times in the past. Now, again, it's not the first time he's planned to launch himself into the sky. This according to Gizmodo. In 2014, he earned himself injuries from intense G-forces and a rough landing, but as the Washington Post notes, he's only recently become a flat Earth convert after, quote, struggling for months to raise funds, unquote. And hence the Research Flat Earth slogan on the side of his rocket. And Hughes plans to launch himself progressively higher into the sky if Saturday's planned event was a non-lethal success. Now, I hope he knows that once you get high up into the sky, you know, there are problems like, oh, I don't know, you know, you need probably air filtration systems, or you could suffer hypoxia. Yeah. And then you could fall to the Earth unconscious due to lack of oxygen and also die. In a Kickstarter post from 2016, Hughes wrote, Mad Mike Hughes always wants to be famous, so much that he decided, what can I do to become the instant superstar Dave Daredevil? So he decided to break the world record for the longest ramp jump in the world. He's the current world record holder for a ramp rocket jump, but he wants to shatter that record on February 12th of 2016. That was, again, the post that he had on his website, and that was just one day before his 60th birthday. Now, while crowdfunding only raised him $310... of the $150,000 goal. Then the Flat Earth Connection later helped him raise $8,000 more. Now, here's the point, and this is what's interesting. Help me launch a rocket on my birthday, $310. Help me launch a rocket to prove the Earth is flat, $8,000.
Yeah, right.
I wonder if he actually went directly to the International Flat Earth Society that met over here, whatever they called here in North Carolina.
Yeah, the Raleigh meeting. I loved in this article, it says he claims to have built the steam-powered rocket out of scrap metal parts in his garage.
So he's into steampunk too.
Yes. Yeah. But the project costs around $20,000, including the purchase of a motorhome off Craigslist that was converted into the ramp. This is the most mom and pop rocket launch ever. I love every second of it.
I mean, part of it's kind of admirable, but the sad thing is that there's actual science that could be done using a lot less apparatus and with similar amounts of funding that nobody wants to do because it's not something like studying the flat Earth. In fact, I'm not convinced this guy's really trying to prove that the Earth is flat. I think he's trying to break a record, and he's trying to appeal to the flat earthers because he knows that they're dumb enough to donate the money. That's my hypothesis. However, the BLM decision seems to have bought Hughes some time before the potentially deadly manned test of his DIY scalding steam missile, time he apparently does not intend to use to reconsider whether this is a good idea or not. And this is the final quote from him I'm going to leave you with, folks. He says, "I don't believe in science." He was previously told the Associated Press, "I know about aerodynamics and fluid dynamics and how things move through the air, about the certain size of rocket nozzles and thrust, but that's not science. That's just formula. There's no difference between science and science fiction." What do you guys think about that? info@graylianreport.com, info@micahhanks.com. I would love to get the ideas of the listenership on that one. We're speaking of sending things into space, Matt. Before Mad Mike takes off, or if he ends up taking off at all, I guess we'll have to see. But there are others who are looking to the sky and hoping to send things there, and not just humans. In fact, Budweiser's talking about sending barley to Mars for future space brewing operations.
First, their, you know, absolutely controversial campaign of renaming the beer America for a year period. Now, on to the stars. Love it.
Yeah, space beer. I mean, that would lift anybody's spirits. Look at this. Wendy's messaging me here in the chat. "Goober, you sound tired tonight. I hope you're not overdoing it." Of course I'm overdoing it. I'm Micah Hanks. But you know what would put me right on point? Better than any kind of energy drink, better than even coffee that I love. That's right. Space brew. You know, a nice dark porter from outer space, that's going to put anybody on point, don't you think? That would help me out. The company Budweiser, their ambitious plan will be carried out on the International Space Station, which is located about 220 miles above Earth. That's incredible because, of course, it orbits our round planet, and you can actually see it as it orbits, passes through the sky every night, and if you're in the right location, you can see it. I've seen it many times. It's not a projection. It's not a, you know, it's not like a hologram from NASA.
Are you sure? How can you prove that, Mike?
Exactly. If you can't actually provide demonstrable evidence, then it is a hologram, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Interesting if true.
Yeah. Now, when Budweiser first announced its plan to get to Mars, they noted the many challenges that lie in the way. For example, the atmosphere may cause the beer that they send to turn into foamy slop. Mars' atmospheric pressure is about 100 times less than Earth's, and gases and liquids don't like to separate, turning the beer into a foamy slop when removed from its packaging. Additional hops, another primary ingredient in beer, will be unlikely to even grow on Mars. God, this is sounding pretty dire for the Martians.
Yeah.
Hops is the bitter agent in beer. It needs plenty of direct sunlight, easy access to water, and a lot of room for vertical growth. On Mars, the sun appears about half the size as it does on Earth, making the use of direct sunlight for hop growth pretty challenging. Duh, all you got to do is just build heat lamps on Mars.
Fortune favors the brave, man.
That's right. That's right. Now, if the beer doesn't successfully make its way to the planet, Budweiser says that their research is still valuable. They believe it will help researchers back down on Earth better understand agriculture. Now, barley isn't the first alcohol ingredient to make its way, at least to the International Space Station. Back in 2011, Ardbeg, which is a Scottish distillery, Raymond Gallagher over in Glasgow. I just kind of ran it all together, Ray, but if you're listening, maybe you have tried the Ardbeg. Apparently, they sent a vial of their unmatured malt whiskey on a spacecraft. The samples were then shipped back down to Earth 3 years later and studied. Get this, findings revealed major differences in aroma and taste, according to the BBC, between the two brews. When I nosed and tasted the space samples, it became clear that much more of Ardbeg's smoky phenolic character shone through to reveal a different set of smoky flavors which I had not encountered here on Earth before. This according to Bill Lumsden. Matt, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I'm thinking this sounds like an experiment I can get behind.
I'm thinking that, you know, you've got aged 8 years, aged 12 years, but what if it's aged in a oaken sherry barrel in space? And what if space aged? Because, I mean, okay, I'm thinking about, like, you got me that vodka.
I started to say, we've had space booze here in the bunker before.
Well, it was sort of space booze. Let's qualify this. It was grain vodka from Earth that was produced on Earth, but it was filtered through a meteorite.
Yeah.
Matt and I have actually tried meteorite-filtered vodka, but this idea is so cool. I mean, again, if aged whiskey is what you're after, why not age your booze in space? I think that is a brilliant idea.
I do too.
But I'm wondering if you would have to actually take it all the way to Mars. Certainly not. Couldn't you just put it in some sort of a storage container in, like, near Earth orbit?
Yeah.
And let it just stay up there for however long, you know? Space age.
Or just go set up a still on the moon, go back in a couple of years, pick it up.
Well, no, that's even more difficult. Again, all if we want to literally, okay, we all hear about living in the space age. This takes space age to a whole new level.
That's true.
Okay, near Earth orbit level. We take our booze into space. We let it remain in near Earth orbit for 8 or 12 years, and it's space aged brew. This is incredible. Yes, this is an idea I could definitely get behind. Hey, speaking of space stuff, by the way, Matt, space dust. It has now been reported. I think Janet Fitzgerald and Mark Brady may have both sent this story along. Our newsies, more of the team members, giving our shout-outs out tonight here. But life on our planet might have originated from biological particles brought to Earth in streams of space dust, this according to a new study. Now, fast-moving flows of interplanetary dust that continually bombard our planet's atmosphere could deliver tiny organisms from far-off worlds or send Earth-based organisms to other planets. The dust streams, according to this study, which was reported by PhysOrg, could collide with biological particles in Earth's atmosphere with enough energy to knock them into space. This, according to scientists, such an event could enable bacteria and other forms of life to make their way from one planet in the solar system to another and perhaps beyond. Pretty interesting concept. And again, it just kind of plays into that idea that, hey, maybe we are all the aliens after all. And that indeed would be fascinating. But maybe we will be aliens in the future in another way, because I know we haven't heard from our friends at Asgardia in a while, Matt. And I think we have an update, which, in fact, I've been waiting to get to this update for about a week now. The story's kind of old news by now, and we really probably should touch on it.
I think so as well. I was really drawn to the story of Asgardia and the kind of implications, especially legal implications, apparently they were facing by collecting private data and servers in space, which are not, you know, necessarily beholden to any laws by country or anything like that.
They're doing with data what we're telling the distilleries to do with their booze.
Yes, exactly.
Storing it in space.
So the world's first space nation has actually taken flight at this point. And on November 12th, Asgardia cemented its presence in outer space by launching the Asgardia 1 satellite. The NanoSat, as it's called, is roughly the size of a loaf of bread, and it undertook a two-day journey from NASA's Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia, the United States, to the International Space Station. It contains 0.5 terabytes of data belonging to 18,000 of Asgardia's citizens, such as family photographs, as well as digital representations of the space nation's flag, coat of arms, and constitution. Russian scientist Igor Ashaberiel founded the first independent nation to operate in outer space in October of last year.
You know, the Russians are really all over this getting independently into space thing. Russia, yeah. And China. I mean, not a big surprise. I know we've got another story that we're going to update on
here. Not much
has
changed since you know, the space race, apparently.
Yeah, so. Although I will mention to you, by the way, I actually got to see some remnants of one of the prototypes for the manned orbital lab that the Russians actually sent into space back in the 70s. It was a secret space program by definition. And that's right, yeah, Beth Arzi and Maria Urdaneta and I, we went to the London Science Museum and got to see this. Really interesting stuff.
Well, Asgardia 1 has actually made its journey to the ISS aboard a NASA commercial cargo ship, which I think is interesting that NASA's kind of, you know, helping this whole project along. And now it must wait for 3 weeks as vital supplies and scientific equipment are transferred from the NASA ship to the 6 people currently living at the ISS. The NanoSat will then be detached from the NASA vehicle and begin its own orbital journey around the Earth. Citizens' data will remain in orbit for between 5 and 18 months, the typical lifespan of this type of satellite. It will then burn out and disappear. So the launch fulfills a pledge that Asgardia has made when establishing the space nation to take its citizens to space via their data. I don't see the 5 to 18 months period being really just, you know, that leap forward. I guess it is a leap forward as far as privatization of the space around the Earth, but seems like a quite short lifespan for something like this.
I guess so. But again, the fundamental, the salient point, I think, that you outlined there, I'm with you, that the existing American space program is cooperating,
yeah,
not only with international players, but also with organizations that are hoping to try and, you know, store and send information to space, to do all kinds of interesting and novel things. Who knows? Maybe this idea that we have, Matt, about getting booze up there into space and letting it age, which would conceivably actually produce colors, flavors, tastes, and textures that we don't experience here on Terra Firma, maybe it's an idea that even those guys up there on the ISS would warm up to. So let's call the boys at NASA and see if we can get them on board. Great idea, man.
Love it.
Good thing we haven't talked about this idea publicly or anything. Hey, we'll be right back after this. It is the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. We are plugging along. So fine. If I were any finer, there might be two of me, and that would mean trouble for everybody else. Glad to be here with you as always, guys. Well, look at this. They're calling you the Oaken Shield in the chat room. Yes, Matt, you are rather dwarf-like in certain capacities.
Am I?
I mean that as a compliment.
I do appreciate it. Thorin was quite the dwarf.
He was quite the dwarf indeed. A goblin cleaver in his own right. You know, if you would like to learn how to cleave goblins, the Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting will not teach you how to do that. However, you will learn an awful lot about the art of audio mixing and entanglement of minds. Well, if not entanglement of minds, at very least perhaps education of the masses. You can get behind the microphone, put your word out there to the bespoken masses, and you can educate, you can entertain, you can enlighten, as we try to do every week on this Graylian Report. So do head over to maverickpodcasting.org. Keep in mind, a book like that would make a fantastic stocking stuffer, something you'd certainly enjoy, or perhaps somebody, one of your tykes, maybe a husband or a wife, a friend of yours, wants to do it. Get into podcasting. It's the best way, in my opinion, having written the book, that you can learn how to be a podcaster. In fact, our pal Richard Dolan, who I understand is not going to be live tonight, Matt, but Richard Dolan asked me the other day to send him a copy of that book because he's going to start dabbling in a bit of podcasting himself.
You've never given me a copy, actually. Have I've just not? Had to read it here in the bunker here and there.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you're mentioned in the book.
I think so.
And having been a podcaster with me for about 8 years, I figured you knew the ins and outs of the art.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe, you know, everybody can brush up from time to time.
That's true. And I do have my collection of Micah Hanks first editions on my shelf as well.
Really? Well, yeah. You know, whatever floats your boat. Yeah, exactly. I'll also say this, too. This is something I really often express to people. They think, well, yeah, podcasting would be great, but if I were going to do a podcast, I mean, what in the world would I talk about? You know, I'm not like you, Mike. I can't just talk about anything and just tell stories. And I said, oh, gosh, you think I'm a storyteller? You should hear James Waldo tell stories. Now, that guy is a storyteller. James, we love him because he has a story about everything. But he bought the book, and he actually got a microphone. He got in fact, Matt, the board he's using is the original Graylian board that we use, not the same one, but I mean the same model that we used for the first 4 or 5 years of the show and which we still travel with. We used it on the Mysteries Cruise with Mike and Wendy. We actually used that board. We brought the original back out and we did the live show there that Graylian X subscribers have already enjoyed and indulged over the holidays along with way too much turkey. Yeah. But again, I always tell people, if you don't think you've got something to talk about, first thing that you should do is find a co-host. Okay, there's always a good conversation going if you got a couple of people. Three's a party, or company, depending on how you look at it. But over the years, we've had, at times, three and even four co-hosts in the studio at times for this show. You can always book guests. You know, if talking isn't your thing, become a question asker. Learn to do interviews, and you can actually interview people and hear their opinions on things. And that's one of the greatest ways, I think, that you can learn new things is to be able to have conversations regularly with people who are knowledgeable and who are skilled in their art or craft. And then finally, when it comes to arts and crafts, people are like, well, what would my subject be if I was going to do a podcast? Here's the thing. All you got to do is you pick something you're passionate about. And this is one reason I tell people, if you're going to do business at all, if you have a side business, if you've got a part-time business that you're opening, you know, an online business, whether it has to do with gardening or whether it has to do with, you know, some sort of hobbies, whether it has to do with collecting or whether it has to do with, you know, any number of different things, whether you do it for profit or whether you do it just for pure enjoyment, those kinds of shows, podcasts that are about little niches and things like that, if you have an obscure interest and you go out there and you're like, dang it, I wish there were more people who podcasted about this. Ding, there you go. You should do it. You should be the podcaster who starts the podcast for your rare or obscure interest. Find your niche and become a voice and put it out there. So the Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting talks not just about here's how you hook up your microphone. It goes over all that stuff, but that's in the first couple of chapters. What I tried to do with that book is explain, here's why podcasting is important. Here are the ways that you can reach your audience, and here's how to find an audience even if you don't think you have something to say. You may be surprised at how much you have to say if you have a unique or special interest that not very many people follow, especially if there's not somebody out there who's doing a podcast about it yet. So check that out. Look, X-Lady says in the chat room, Micah, you should go for 4 hours. Again, there can be such a thing as too much of a good thing. That's right. And I think in the Victorian Guide to Etiquette that came long before the Guide to Podcasting, Matt, it always says it's polite to leave the table a little hungry, as we intend to do each week. Give them enough, but leave them a little hungry. Now, if you are, of course, one who likes to overindulge, and if you have to have your appetizers and your dessert too, maybe two of them, you know, you're the two scoops of ice cream kind of person, if you head over to GraylianReport.com/X, you can get additional weekly podcasts, monthly specials, and then the two-hour Graylian Report will not be all you have to enjoy each week. You'll have far more content than you could probably shake a stick at. So that's the Graylian X podcast and all the related content. Find it at GraylianReport.com/X. We implore you to sign up and check that out. We are sure, of course, that you'll enjoy it too. Okay, so Matt, you know, there's some interesting news buzzing over there in the great state of California, and The Guardian was reporting on this. In fact, right now, we've got recreational marijuana, and it's about to be legalized in that state in 2018, but there are some who are already on the ground and are pushing for movements toward the legalization of psilocybin, a.k.a. magic mushrooms, in California, that they think that that needs to be what happens next, and not because people need to go out there and play around and take drugs. They're urging for this to become a legal kind of a therapy for different people. And you'll notice if you ever hear us talk about this on this show, that is the direction we go with that conversation, because I do think that certain, especially natural remedies, but certain holistic treatments, natural remedies and things like this, if they are of this earth, if they seem to have curative properties or other effects that contribute to well-being, and yet they are criminalized and made illegal and people who own them or use them are thereby, you know, prosecuted, I'm not down with that. And when guys like Graham Hancock talk about this war on consciousness, it sometimes also goes down deeper than that. When certain people find these medicinal substances to be of value and that they improve their lives and they don't cause harm to themselves or to others and they're not being used in an obstructive, destructive way. Again, it is a little silly that people can be prosecuted for these kind of things. And so I'm glad that there are people and politicians even who are saying, look, maybe it is time that we open this dialogue. We're starting to see it slowly, state by state, with marijuana, finally. Decriminalization and sometimes outright legalization. And thereby, the state is able to regulate and sell some of these things and even make money off of this, right?
Well, this whole discussion makes me hearken back to Bill Hicks. I know, a favorite here in the bunker. But he talked about mushrooms quite a bit in one of his stand-up albums. Great album.
Yeah.
He said, facetiously, of course, I'm glad mushrooms are against the law, because I took them one time, and you know what happened to me? I laid in a field of green grass for 4 hours going, my God, I love everything. Yeah, now, if that isn't a hazard to our country, I don't know what is. How are we going to justify arms dealing when we realize that we're all one?
Yeah. Well, again, that sense of oneness. Unfortunately, and Graham Hancock has talked about this when he talks about this sickness of spirit, and I've talked about this in the past a lot recently because it's something I'm passionate about. I do think it's important that we understand science and what science does. I am in no way, shape, or form a person who is against science. And frankly, there are certain people in the fringe communities who I appreciate, and I actually enjoy their perspectives on things until they get to that point where they just say, and the quackademics, you know, the academicians are all crazy, they don't know anything. No, I disagree. There is a lot. There is more than probably any one person on Earth will ever know in terms of the cumulative affordances made by science for humanity. I mean, it has made our lives and our way of life so much better on this planet. The problem is that people who get trapped in a certain way of thinking, if they are within the scientific community and they begin to disallow concepts or strategies or ideologies or discoveries because it doesn't conform to a narrow worldview, which they have made themselves, you know, a part of, or they are beholden for whatever reason to. That is where we have that kind of a problem. And again, I don't say that science is bad and that academicians are innately bad because they adhere to science. No, science is the way forward. It is the way of modernity, the way of progress. It has helped us. It is as a process something that is useful, and it must be recognized as such. Whether you are a fringeologist or an academician extraordinaire, this is something that is important. You have to understand what science can do for us when it is properly employed. But there are people who employ science in the wrong ways. You could call it bad science, and people, I think, on both sides of belief, skepticism, fringe, you know, mainstream, whatever, people on both sides of whatever that paradigm you want to call it or however you want to label it, do that. Now, again, what I'm talking about is if it's non-harmful, if its use is not harmful to others, and if there are clear benefits derived from responsible, controlled use of a substance, I definitely think that at least for medicinal purposes or for purposes of treatment, therapy, etc., that it is something that should be looked at within the broader context of legality. And that's what's happening. Kevin Saunders, a mayoral candidate for the city of Marina, just south of San Francisco Bay, that's what he's doing. He's filed a proposal that would exempt adults over the age of 21 from any penalties that would relate to possession, growing, selling, or transporting psychedelic psilocybin mushrooms. Now, The Guardian reports if he can get 365,880 voter signatures by the end of April 2018, the California Psilocybin Legalization Initiative will then be placed on the statewide ballot. California listeners, I don't know how you guys feel about this. This may be something you'll want to be aware of. Just saying. Now, Saunders thinks that now is the right time because he says the drug can help bring the current political divide. And further, he says, restore a sense of community. The world is really hurting and everybody is at a loss about what's going on right now with Trump, Brexit, the refugee crisis, and everything else. I'm at a loss at what to do politically, but the only thing I feel like we could do is to get psilocybin into more people's hands. Now, I realize that that would probably sound dangerous and destructive to a few people out there. But here's what he says, and his reason for saying this. He says, it deflates the ego, it strips down your own walls and defenses, and allows you to look at yourself in a different light. He adds, it could allow people to figure out what to do and could revolutionize the way we treat those with depression, addiction, and even things like cluster headaches. Now, a profound magic mushroom experience actually helped Saunders get over a debilitating 5-year heroin addiction back in 2003. He was 32 at that time. He said, I got to the root of why I made a conscious decision to become a heroin addict. I've been clean now for almost 15 years.
And that is one of the things that I think is so fundamentally, you know, staggering to me as to why psilocybin mushrooms are still listed as a Schedule 1 substance, along with marijuana. Schedule 1 substances include things like bath salts, heroin, GHB, the date rape drug, methaqualone, which is Quaaludes, things like that. Things that are highly addictive, highly dangerous in their own right, and yet you have something like psilocybin, which has been shown to effectively treat opiate addiction in the same category. It just doesn't, I don't understand how you circle that square.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, although I see these kind of anti-addictive properties and things is important. What he talks about, you know, stripping away your ego, becoming more harmonious with nature and with your community, these are all things that are important too. And I think that in truth, just a deeper awareness of yourself. Now, you know, Matt and I, it's no secret, from time to time differ on our interpretation of the nature of some of these things, which is fine because I'm all about people being individuals and having different ideas about things. I don't want yes men all around me. I want people who can engage in rigorous debate with me about things, which we're not going to do right now. But But I'm gonna.
You got me excited for a second.
Yeah, but because then it would be the rest of the hour. And we got the stuff we got to talk about here. But I do want to say that whether you are someone like Matt, who I think says this is all in your mind, or whether you are someone who, like me, is more open to the idea that maybe whatever the chemical processes that occurred during a hallucinatory kind of an experience like this allow you to engage aspects of reality that maybe are something else. Whether that, again, is something that's, I'm sure it's accessed from within the mind. I don't dispute that. I'm just saying that there may be realities on a broader plane of existence that we are able to glean knowledge from during that experience. I wrote a book about this, and therefore, I mean, from my perspective, and not with a complete lack of acknowledgement to the pharmacological studies and also the psychological studies as it relates to all this. Again, for me, if I had to think about this practically, I would say, sure, of course, it's all happening in the mind, but I do maintain that I think that there are aspects of reality and what we perceive as reality that may not be quite as they appear to be. If this weren't the case, we wouldn't have philosophical conundrums, which are now beginning to actually get into the realms of mathematics and physics as well, that deal with ideas like a holographic universe. Again, if in some capacity what we experience as reality is some sort of a matrix-like universe, a constructed sort of state of being in which we exist as players, could these hallucinatory experiences allow access on a plane into a level of knowledge or existence even beyond that which we perceive alone? In which case, we could even say that perhaps certain technologies, not just spiritual ones like entheogens, may allow us to glean information in similar ways. And here's what I'm talking about. USA Today actually reported on this today. I'm going to read the headline to you. No need for magic mushrooms. Hallucination machine takes you on a drug-free trip. A machine, they say, that recreates the effects of hallucinations. Now, Matt, you're shaking your head. Maybe, and I want to ask you for the same reason that I looked at this and thought, not so sure about this. I think this could be useful. But they're saying that a machine has, it's basically like a virtual reality setup. They say this recreates all the effects of a hallucination like magic mushrooms and that you don't need the mushrooms. Now, I disagree. Let's read the story. Then I want your opinion on why.
Okay.
Let's see if we actually have come full circle and found common ground. Now, they say researchers in the UK are using virtual reality to create a machine capable of generating drug-free hallucinations. In a study published in the journal Scientific Reports, researchers at the Sackler Center for Consciousness Science at England's University of Sussex combined a virtual reality platform with Google computer program Deep Dream to build a hallucination machine. Now, in the study, users viewed a series of panoramic videos featuring natural scenes through a virtual reality headset. Researchers then used a visualization algorithm called Deep Dream to produce biologically realistic visual hallucinations. And after viewing the scenes, participants actually found that hallucinations from the machine were similar to hallucinations induced by psilocybin, a psychedelic drug, and the active ingredient in the so-called magic mushrooms. Now, Anil Seth, whose name we have read in the past as it relates to similar studies, by the way, he was one of the lead researchers of this study, and he said that the machine can offer an understanding of how the brain works when experiencing hallucinations caused by either drugs or psychiatric conditions. He said, unraveling the brain basis of unusual perceptual experiences like hallucinations is important both for understanding how normal everyday conscious perception works, and it also sheds new light onto how changes in visual processing in the brain lead to specific kinds of hallucinatory experience. Now, Mr. Seth says he wants to tweak the machine for future research to stimulate different hallucinatory experiences and to combine them with brain imaging. This, he says, will help us come closer to understanding how our brain generates visual experience, both in normal everyday life and also during these hallucinatory episodes. But when people start saying, no need for magic mushrooms, this machine will take you on a drug-free trip and create all the same things, I'm not so sure that that's the case. Visually, yeah, you may experience what looks like a hallucinatory experience, but when you hear people talk about the curative aspects of psilocybin, the anti-addiction capacities that the psilocybin seems to have and how people are able to have a mushroom experience. And they are able to come back from this experience with a harmonious sense of oneness with the universe, a renewed sense of self in relation to the world around them and others that they coexist alongside. And they also say it helped me understand the problem I was facing with addiction and I kicked the habit. I don't know that putting on virtual reality headgear is going to have the same effect, especially if what the psilocybin does is create a chemical change in your body's chemistry and in the mind, which has that positive effect. Matt, I want your opinion on all that.
So I feel like I have to choose my wording quite carefully here, or else you may entrap me.
Okay.
But yes, I agree that you can produce the visual element or the auditory element, but that is not what speaks to the heart of, admittedly, from somebody who has taken magic mushrooms. That is not what speaks to the heart of the experience. And whether you want to call it, dare I say, a soul, that may be some form of it. The human psychology behind it, and whatever motivates us as spiritual beings throughout the universe, not necessarily religious, but spiritual beings, I think it speaks to... You brought up reality, for instance, a moment ago. And I feel that like there's a big difference that we have to acknowledge between a kind of a physical and a philosophical realities. They're two separate things. Now, the philosophical reality would be something affected by the magic mushrooms, and the physical reality being, you know, the tangible desk I have in front of me. Yes, the psychological can indirectly affect the physical, but... You know, not directly, I feel. So the idea of manufacturing this stuff via machine, I think, undermines the process as a spiritual method. For lack of a better word, like I said, I feel like I'm sounding more like I'm on your side of things here as far as the universe expanding and existing outside of our own consciousness. But I'm sure we agree on this.
Well, it is, because this presents a unique circumstance where we are looking at the juxtaposition between a chemically induced experience and what is not just a perceived hallucination, i.e. visually, okay, and then a electronic apparatus that recreates that experience without the actual chemical underpinnings. And as you said, rightly so, the spiritual part, and it's fine to say spiritualism, I think, in this situation, Matt,
yeah,
because it's spiritual in the sense that there is that deep yearning that is tapped into within the heart of the human or the soul of the human, you know, whatever you want to call it. That is what this plays into. Is it all a chemical experience? Sure it is. But, you know, again, we can talk all day about, let's discuss the science behind love and altruism. Is there really such a thing as altruism? Most would say, well, I guess there can be such a thing as altruism. And there can be such a thing as true unconditional love. But again, I've always made the point that a lot of the iterations to me of altruism and true love are counter to evolution, even if they are in a protective sense, i.e. like a parent protecting their child. It's not just about protecting yourself. It's not just about protecting your progeny. There's obviously something more to the belief in love and sharing a deep spiritual connection. That, again, is, I think, where a great way spiritual comes into the conversation. Yeah. Sharing a deep spiritual connection with somebody that you say you love. Again, as humans, I really don't think we've... talk about the great mysteries. We were talking about sleep while we were down there on the dig over the weekend. Jason Pentrail and I were talking about sleep mysteries. And I told Jason, you know, this was brought up to me previously by Cam from Expanded Perspectives. He and I were sitting in a Tex-Mex restaurant in Dallas. And Cam says, listen, player, you want to really, really, really blow your mind. Think about this, man. Why do people sleep? Okay? Why do people sleep? Figure that one out. And I'm like, yeah, Cam, that's a pretty good point you make there. Why do people, I mean, I know why people have to sleep, but think about it in the broader context. Sometimes I think the greatest mysteries aren't the weird things out there that exist on other planets, you know, light years away. I think understanding the nature of our own biological processes, sleep, you know, love, spirituality, all these kind of things, understanding our relationship with nature and the cosmos, all these things are important. And I think that, you know, we have to look at some of the other stuff, too. Now, this definitely decidedly steps over into the weird, but I'm going to just say, there's this great show. I tweeted about this earlier because in advance of this conversation, I was thinking about it. Matt, are you familiar with the program? This is some true lost lore of television history and of the very best kind, because all the episodes apparently are now on YouTube. It's an old show, and it was called One Step Beyond.
Oh, of course.
You do know about this?
Yeah.
So the pilot episode, right, they had Andrea Puharich on there. And he had a very weird background with all this stuff. Everything from, I mean, he discovered Uri Geller. He was a psychedelics researcher. He studied telekinesis and all this stuff. Go online, folks at home. Go on YouTube. Look up One Step Beyond, that first episode.
after listening to the Madness song, One Step Beyond, then go watch the show.
Yeah, there you go. But that first episode, that's what they talk about, is do these psychedelic mushrooms elicit telekinetic or ESP kind of effects? And they were trying to test this on this show. Now, we've been looking forward to getting into this for a long time. We finally have the time tonight to do this. Matt had suggested we do a segment on CIA operations, Pentagon programs, and research into ESP. We're going to dive into this in a moment with some audio commentary from one of the key players who was at the heart of this. And then I'll leave it up to you, the dear listeners, to decide, was there merit to the psychic experimentations being conducted by the U.S. government? And does it, maybe at least in part, make a case for the veracity of that phenomenon? We'll delve into this in a moment when we return on the Grailian Report. Appalachian Mountains, it is the Grailian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with the kind-eyed Reverend Matt Oakley, hobo floating out there in space-time someplace, and all the fine gang here at Team Grailian hanging out and bringing news, views, and, of course, from time to time, I truly think innovative ideas. If not innovative, maybe we could at least say renovative. That's right. Sometimes we need a little renovation of the old mind here. And that's apparently exactly what certain scientists starting in the 1970s were trying to do when they began working on rather clandestine technologies, some would say of the spiritual variety, in an effort to try and broaden the mind in new ways that could also have military and strategic advantage over the enemy, especially during the Cold War. That's right. Psychic spies are what we're talking about here on the Grailian Report. And Matt, this idea about scientists digging into all this and trying to find, you know, again, trying to find evidence of psychic phenomena that could then be applied to military projects. It's always fascinated me, and partly because I know that we weren't the only ones doing it. I've got a book over here that's titled Psychic Experiments Behind the Iron Curtain, talking about the Soviets doing the exact same kind of a thing. During the Cold War, it was a common theme among military intelligence agencies, hey, around the world, but especially between the Soviets and the U.S., let's see what we can develop. So anyway, Newsweek, of all places, had a pretty good article about this back in 2015 that kind of delves into some of the history of what was going on there.
Yeah, and I have to say that in regards to the Bill Hicks quote that I mentioned a few moments ago, you have to laugh, right? That he talks about the spirituality, the function of the mind, how amazing it is that we are all one being, you know, spiritually and, you know, philosophically, all up here. And yet, you know, how could we sell arms if we if we all realize that? And yet here we are utilizing, if it's real, quite possibly one of the most fundamentally, the fundamental things that could bring humankind together for military purposes. So anyway.
And by the way, if you want to read an excerpt from this article, in the interest of time, would you mind jumping down to the heading portion there that talks about Washington's most expensive psychics?
Yes.
You were probably going to do that anyway. But
I was.
just because I've got a bunch of audio sound bites I want to make sure we get in. Okay, yeah. Go ahead. So
20 years ago this month, the CIA released a report with the unassuming title, An Evaluation of Remote Viewing Research and Applications. It's a 183-page white paper, which is more like a white flag. It was the CIA's public admission, after years of speculation, that U.S. government agencies have been using a type of ESP called remote viewing for more than two decades to help collect military and intelligence secrets. At a cost of about $20 million, the program had employed psychics to visualize hidden extremist training sites in Libya, describe new Soviet submarine designs, and pinpoint the locations of U.S. hostages held by foreign kidnappers. But the report conducted by the CIA, by the Independent American Institute for Research, did much more than confirm the existence of the highly classified program. It declared that the psychic spy operation, codenamed Stargate, was a bust. Yes, the CIA researchers had validated some Stargate trials, finding that hits occur more often than chance, and that something beyond odd statistical hiccups is taking place. But the report declared that ESP was next to worthless for military use because the tips provided are too vague and ambiguous to produce actionable intelligence.
Okay, let me just say real quick. Here's the thing. They correctly say that, well, there wasn't enough consistency. And without enough consistency, the military application here is highly questionable. Yeah, hits would occur more often than chance, and something beyond statistical hiccups seem to be happening. But that alone isn't worth putting millions of dollars into. And that was their fundamental point. And yet, this is interpreted by people as meaning nothing to see here. Move along. The skeptics rest their argument on that, and this report and its findings. Going back further in time, again, because this one was published in, what was it? The report was published in, I believe, 1995, but it was talking about, of course, research that occurred decades before that. So anyway.
Interesting, by the way, the link to the report on Newsweek, when I found this story several weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
It was there. Now it's no longer there.
I can tell you probably why it's not, though. Yeah. Actually, I'd been given heads up. There are a lot of CIA and FBI had decided to take down a lot of their more woo-woo kind of articles, which is bizarre. I'm not sure exactly why they did that. Maybe they you could say it was server space. I don't know. But
you can still find it online, of course.
The copies of the report still exist. But yeah, it's interesting because a lot of stuff that's been on the FBI.gov and also CIA.gov websites, they have taken a lot of these reports down. And somebody recently made that made a point to, it may have been Nick Redfern that brought, I think it was Nick Redfern back on the Ancient Mysteries cruise. He told me that a lot of these reports you're not going to be able to get access, at least through the sites, any longer. Now again, what's interesting to me about this is that
this was actually, this paper was published September 29th 1995.
Yeah, there you go. 1995. Okay, so. And relating to, the experiences that those involved had in the years leading up to that. So we're looking at, a good 40, 50, maybe even 60 years with some of these reports going even further back. Looking at, a broad history of the government and its involvement and its interest in these kind of things. And because, again, there wasn't rock-solid, indisputable, consistent evidence that was forthcoming and usable in a strategic way, they said, we're not going to keep putting money into this. But that doesn't mean that there isn't, at very least, a certain degree of control that those experiencers seem to have that was indicative of some phenomenon. And that's why I want to talk about this a little bit. Now, Russell Targ was one of those researchers who was involved with all this. And there was, we talked about Graham Hancock in the last hour and how he famously said during a TEDx presentation that there is a war on consciousness. That presentation he gave, the TED Talk, was subsequently banned, as well as a talk given by his colleague Rupert Sheldrake, whose theory of morphic resonance, along with Hancock's argument that certain psychedelic drugs may be beneficial and may help us glean deeper awareness and knowledge of ourselves, these were considered dangerous pseudoscientific ideas, and talks were removed from the TED website. They were subsequently, due to public outcry, put back on the TED site, but with a disclaimer warning people about the content, which I think is, unfortunately on an FCC broadcast, I can't say what I think that is, but folks, use your imagination. Okay? It might rhyme with a word like hole fit. Okay? Now, when I looked at into this story and I thought, I'd like to see what Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ and these guys had to say, at first I thought that there was a TED talk that Russell Targ had given. As it turns out, this was an independent conversation. It was a short talk, a little longer than the average TED talk, which is about 20 minutes. This was given in California a few years ago. It was initially intended to be part of a TED talk. Once TED found out that Russell Targ was going to be talking about actual government taxpayer-funded psychic experiments carried out by the CIA and his involvement as a physicist with them, TED backed out, wouldn't have anything to do with it. Because that's such a crazy idea that a physicist who is a man of science who was tasked with studying psychic phenomena at the behest of the CIA throughout the 1970s and 80s, because he's talking about his experiences and sharing some of the relevant documentation now that this is all public knowledge, because that's so crazy. TED backed out. They wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Even though they're backing the head transplant guy currently.
Exactly. You want to talk about crazy. Now, he may not be wrong in the coming years, but again, TED is supposed to be leading the way with innovative ideas, and yet when they actually have someone and something that has not only government documentation but certain degrees of science that backs it up, we're not going to have anything to do with this. Russell Targ, let's get to the audio sound bites. I've got three of them here where he begins to explain his role with the CIA, what they were aiming to do, and some of the experiments, and actually the results of those experiments. As you're going to see, not only was there a greater than statistical likelihood, I think that there's quite a good bit of detail in terms of what they were able to determine through that clandestine process known as remote viewing.
My name is Russell Targ, and I'm a physicist, and it's my great pleasure to tell you about the remarkable work we did at Stanford Research Institute investigating psychic abilities. We did that for the CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, NASA, and many, many other intelligence agencies, part of the U.S. government intelligence system. I got into all this as a childhood magician, standing on the stage in New York doing mental magic. And I had the experience from time to time of having a direct perception of something in the life stream of the person whose mind I was pretending to read or whose fortune I was pretending to tell. So I was not a real psychic. I was just a kid doing magic. But I've now talked to people like Kreskin and Melbourne Christopher, and they said, oh yes, every professional magician knows that from time to time you're given some material and you can then supplement your magic trick with whatever ESP comes to you. And there are many magicians who do that, as we know. But I was not doing magic for the CIA. As we know, the CIA is not easily amused, and we were trying to do the real thing for them. The work we did at SRI involved things like finding a downed Russian airplane in North Africa with code books on it, locating a kidnapped American general in northern Italy, looking into a Soviet weapons factory in Soviet Siberia, describing the construction of a huge Soviet submarine in northern Russia. And we even looked in on a Chinese atomic bomb test 3 days before it was scheduled to go off and described correctly that it was going to fail. So we did quite a lot of useful things for the government during our 23-year program. The ability we're talking about is a natural psychic ability that we all have, in spite of what you may have heard to the contrary. People can quiet their mind and describe and experience what's happening in a distant place or in the future. And this has been talked about for thousands of years. Buddhists have a vast lore about what this is and how to do it and why it's desirable. And I'll try and talk about that later. The ability allows you to quiet your mind and describe and experience what's happening in the future. And you can do that independent of the distance. The most interesting thing that we found as physicists is that it's no harder to describe what's happening in Soviet Siberia, 6,000 miles away, than it is for you to describe the funny object I have in my pocket. 6,000 miles away does not decrease the accuracy or the reliability as compared with something nearby. Looking into the distance is no harder than looking at a contemporaneous event. And that's why this is called a non-local perception. Not quantum mechanical particularly. It pertains to the fact that we live in a non-local space-time described as scientifically, most recently by Schrodinger, in the 1920s and then proved in the 1970s and 1980s. So the idea of non-local connections is not new age. This is accepted in the physical community. The hottest topic in modern physics is exploring non-locality. It was described originally by the Buddhists 2,000 years ago, but modern physics has finally caught up. The leaders of the program that we had at SRI are all physicists. The physicists are taking over what used to be called parapsychology. The three leaders of the program were myself and Ed and Hal Puthoff, who are both laser physicists, and Ed May, who is a nuclear physicist. And we were eager that our scientific friends would not think that we'd gone off the rails into ESP research, so we made sure that we published everything we did, all of our experiments, in the world's most prestigious journals, where we would normally publish our science. So we published our work in the Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical Engineers, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Institute of Physics, and Nature magazine. So this is not, I just want to emphasize that at the time we were doing this work, this was mainstream, written up in the New York Times, published in the premier journals in the world. And I want to give you an idea of where I was when this all began. In the 1960s, I was a hardcore laser guy. That was my career. I've been in laser. I was a laser pioneer. I was working with lasers many years before there were any lasers. So this was the outgrowth of my earliest studies in graduate school.
Okay, so long story short, he was involved in laser technology. Interestingly, I'm going to skip that part because what he talked about was he was building lasers that could operate more efficiently and that could produce more energy than they believed could be done at the time. He could burn a hole in a brick, and they said, you can't do that. They considered it borderline paranormal what he was able to do, but because he was able to do it in a way with science that others could not at that time. And I think you could say that Russell Targ fundamentally came at this with this idea of, well, if they say I can't, I'll look at the science and see what we really can and cannot do. And so then the CIA says, well, let's do this psychic experimentation. Does not, cannot, should not exist. Russell Targ says, let's do some experiments and let's see.
The question that led to my recent book, I wrote a book with a provocative subtitle, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. And the idea is that proof is evidence so strong that you can't statistically or reasonably deny it. That's what we mean by proof. You can't prove scientific things in the laboratory the way you prove mathematical theorems. You prove things in the laboratory by piling up so much evidence that it's simply unreasonable to deny it. So here we are in our laboratory, 1973. There's Pat Price in the middle. Pat Price was one of our great, great psychics. He was police commissioner of Burbank and retired.
Retired police commissioner of Burbank, California. Keep that in mind. He's describing a photograph that he showed during the lecture here with Pat Price himself and another individual.
He's playing here with an ESP teaching machine that was the basis of our first NASA program. My idea was, can you offer feedback and reinforcement and help people improve their psychic ability with a little random game where you have to guess which picture will be illuminated? The answer is yes, you can learn. And the great good news for you today is that game is now available as a free application for your iPhone. So I posted that as a little gift. It's called ESP Trainer, and you can just download it and have it on your iPhone. It'll ring a bell when you get the right answer and show you a pretty picture. So that's Pat Price. Price was an extraordinary psychic. He lived in a psychic bubble. He was an inspiration for me as to what ESP looks like in an evolved person. We were once called by the Berkeley Police Department, where Patricia Hearst was kidnapped, and they said, we're so desperate, can you help us with your ESP program? It shows how desperate they were. And Pat Price and Hal Puthoff and I drove to Berkeley. And Price said, let's see your mug book. He's a no-nonsense guy. He'd been in lots of police stations. I want to see the picture book with all the usual suspects. He turned the page after page, and said, that's the guy. That's the ringleader. And he put his finger on Donald DeVries, who was indeed the ringleader. It's extraordinary. But they learned that only 2 weeks later. the police said, well, can you tell us something right now that'll help us? And Pry said, would you like to know where the kidnap car is? And he said, you're kidding. He said, well, so if you drive about 50 miles north on Bayshore Free on Highway 101, the kidnap car is a white station wagon. It's on the right, parked by a diner across from two large white gas storage cylinders in the pedestrian overpass across the freeway. And one of the detectives said, well, I know where that is. That's on my way to my home in Vallejo. 20 minutes later, they had found the car, and there are still cartridges rolling around on the floor of the car. That's as close to magic as I've ever seen in my 20 years in the laboratory. And
again, this was just a random situation where they've been doing this experiment, and they're contacted by local law enforcement. Keep in mind that the guy who's the quote-unquote psychic working with him is a retired police commissioner from Burbank. He goes out there, asks for their book. He's looking through mugshots and says, this is your guy. 2 weeks later, it was confirmed that this was the ringleader and that this was the guy they were looking for. And he was able to psychically, so they say, interpret the location of the vehicle. Now, listen, I've often said that I'm the most unentertaining and unextraordinary person to ever talk about the extraordinary and entertaining on a podcast. But if there's one weird thing that's happened to me a few times in my life, it involves dreams or experiences that I've had. And I never have formalized experience and experiments with this kind of a thing until, I guess, maybe the middle of last year. And it was first proposed to me by Tiffany Mack. Tiffany said, you know, let's mess around with remote viewing. This is interesting enough. Let's just try it and just see what happens. I'm going to think of something, see if you can predict or if you can discern what I'm seeing. And I said, okay, sure. And I did it exactly like Russell Targ's talking about. I just quieted my mind. I didn't try to guess. I went with the first and the most ridiculous images that came to my mind. And she said, okay, I've got my image. Go ahead. And I said, all right. I see a house. I see a fireplace. And I see a gingerbread man. Those are the first three things that came to mind. Pretty random and you know, maybe even ridiculous with the gingerbread man. It was like a little dancing gingerbread man. I said, I see a house, a fireplace, and a gingerbread man. She says, wow. She says, okay, what I was thinking of, and I'm going to, and she carries the, we had FaceTime going, or if we didn't, I think she opened it at that point because she wanted to show me. She pulls up FaceTime and she says, I'm going to walk over here and show you. She and her daughters had made a gingerbread house the night before. They put it on the mantle above the fireplace. She said, you said you saw a house, a fireplace, and a gingerbread man. We made a gingerbread house that I put above the fireplace on the mantle. She, that's what I was thinking. She says, okay. And I said, well, you know, one, three out of, you know, whatever, not bad. I said, it could be coincidence. And
two out of three ain't bad. You turned into meatloaf for a second there.
Almost, yeah. but so she said, we'll try another one real quick. Okay, I make a mean grilled cheese. What kind of cheese do I use? And I said, and at that point she goes, come on, you know it. And then it came directly into my mind and I said, it's Munster cheese. And she says, yes, it is. And I mean, it was crazy. So we started and we actually began to keep Tiffany and I for a time, a log of what we thought were what appeared to be synchronistic or psychic experiences. One of which I won't go into all the details about right now, but it had to do with a earthquake that occurred earlier this year in Mexico, a large earthquake, and a dream that she had. And that was maybe the one that really took the ticket. I should get her on sometime, and she and I can talk about it at length. But we've got one more soundbite from Russell Targ that I want to talk about here. And again, if you're someone out there who has ever had these kind of experiences, again, I have too. There are two ways of looking at it. Is there actually a valid experience happening? Or as certain psychologists would try and tell you, you are experiencing a delusion where you cause yourself to believe that the experience happened based on a misperception of various things. Like, for instance, one psychological phenomena attributed to these kinds of precognition, serendipitous kind of experiences, deja vu and things like that, they call hindsight bias, where neurons in the brain are firing so quickly that you perceive the order of events as they occur backwards, and you perceive that something that you thought you experienced or perceived before it happened actually happened later. Psychologically, your mind tells you in reverse order that those things happened, and you're like, oh my God, I predicted that. Well, in this day of smartphones, the day and age of smartphones, I should say, computers, video cameras that everybody's got in their pockets. I mean, again, there are plenty of experiences that I think are perhaps a little better documented. And I can tell you that with the documentation that Tiffany and I were doing, we made great care to note the time that certain things happened so that we could look at temporally later. We could go back and review and see the temporal arrangement of events. This was not hindsight bias, although I think that the importance of the, whatever you want to call them, remote viewed visions or whatever, might not be all that great. They're fairly innocuous, if anything, and pretty tame, pretty prosaic little predictions, which are not overtly useful, which to me about really kind of says something about it. The mundanity of the predictions and the fact that they don't really seem to have a whole lot to do with anything very concerning seems to say to me that this is just a natural function of the mind. It's not some sort of a secret mutant power some people have and they can predict who the next president's going to be or something. Most of the information gleaned is inconsequential and almost humorous, which seems to suggest, again, a mundane kind of a everyday aspect to this. Russell Targ, one more point, though, here, where he discusses some of the things that he and his team working with the CIA were able to discern back in the day.
So the demonstration of ability test that we had from the CIA, John McMahon, who's head of the CIA, said to us, you guys are wasting your time looking at swimming pools and churches. We have targets that would be of national security help. Can you describe a target and I'll send you the coordinates? So Price and I climbed back into our little shielded phone booth. And he said, well, I'm psychically laying on a building and a giant crane is rolling back and forth over my body. There's a huge crane. It has eight wheels, four on either side of the building. And in this building, they're constructing a 60-foot steel sphere and they're welding it together. That all turned out to be entirely true. In fact, it was so true that after the steel sphere was verified, we then had a congressional investigation called by the House Intelligence Oversight Committee to see if there had been a security leak. This, in the spirit of no good deed goes unpunished. But the Congress eventually said what we're doing is okay. We were supported by CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency and told to press on, and we pressed on for another 15 years. Another experiment that I'll show you because it's of particular interest to me is that Hal Puthoff then went to travel. I was the interviewer through all of these. My vision's very poor, as you probably caught on, so I don't drive. And Hal was always the outbound person, and I was a stay-at-home psychic travel agent working with the person trying to elicit a description of the distant place. So this time, Hal was on a business and pleasure trip to Colombia, South America, and each day, Price sitting with me would describe, I see a church, I see a volcano, there's a harbor, there's a market, and on day five he didn't show up. So in the spirit that the show must go on, I said, well, I'll describe it. I've never done a remote viewing before, but I'd interviewed countless psychics and other visitors, so I knew the moves. So I said, well, this is Russ Targ, remote viewing with Pat Price. Price isn't here. When I close my eyes, I see something that looks like an airport on an island. There's ocean at the end of the runway. There's sand and grass on the right. There's an airport building on the left. That's what I get. And that's where he was. He was on an island airport off the coast of Colombia called San Andreas. My great coincidence of the day, as I was driving here, I was talking to the cab driver. He was from San Andreas and gave me a color photograph of the airport on the island. How's that for, this is my lucky day. I don't claim that's ESP. That's what you call a lucky day. I finally escaped from the laboratory and got to travel cross country, and two other people were psychically tracking me. The first place I went was New Orleans, and no one knew, of course, where I was, and I chose my target by throwing a die on the pavement. And the die sent me to the New Orleans Superdome. So I was standing in front of the Superdome recording my coordinates. This is noon. This is Russell Targ. I'm standing in front of the Superdome. It looks like a flying saucer shining in the sun. Bad thing to say. Back in the laboratory, my friend, another physicist, Gary Langford, very psychic, straight-up physicist, was working with Elizabeth Rauscher, who interviewed him. She's another physicist. All these people are professional physicists interested in psychic stuff. Gary said, well, I have a clear picture of a circular building. It looks like a giant UFO. Do you think Russell's been abducted? So Elizabeth said, just tell me what you see, make a drawing. And of course, his drawing was a remarkably accurate. This was his also first remote viewing. Gary just came in and said, well, I've been doing this all my life, avocationally. That's how I was an analyst, looking at photo analysts, looking at specs of buildings and describing what's inside. So he was experienced to look at fuzzy images. But here we just took away the image, but it didn't interfere with his ability at all. Our great pleasure was then to have this Army intelligence ask us to train, to set up a psychic Army Corps, something like in the men who stare at goats, but not quite. No goats were killed in our program. But we chose six Army officers to work with us from a big, big group that we interviewed, Hal and I interviewed. One of those was Joe McMonagle, who Joe is still alive and is probably the greatest living psychic today, prodigious psychic. And his first trial, sitting with me, what's this remote viewing stuff? All of these people are basically tough Army officers, showed up in their boots and leather jackets and their patches and their backpacks. So I described remote viewing as I always do. I've been doing workshops now for 20 years. My ritual, the shibboleth, is close your eyes, quiet your mind, and describe the surprising pictures that appear in your awareness. Don't try and name it. Don't try and guess. Just describe the surprising images. And that language was understood 1,200 years ago and appears in Patanjali's guide, Self-Liberation for Seeing with Naked Awareness. So Joe drew this picture. He said, he and his colonel went with Hal Puthoff. And Joe said, I see a building with stripes in front and a long portion behind, a little fountain. He drew what was there, and of course the judges had no problem matching that. With our six Army officers, that I'll describe later, there's six people who had never done this before. I had them each do six trials a week, and we had each one, so we had 30 for 6 weeks, so we had 36 trials. You'd expect them to get six first place matches by chance. We got 19 first place matches, and they set up the Psychic Army Corps and ran another 15 years. They had 30 people on the East Coast working in tandem with the SRI group.
It was a pretty elaborate operation that they had, long story short, and sure they had some results. And again, if you go on YouTube, you can see that entire lecture that Ted wouldn't allow or that they wouldn't sponsor, which Russell Targ gave about. Again, you can pretend it never happened all you want to, and you can also undermine the effects, even though they found that while it was not of strategic use to them and was not controllable to a degree where it could be useful, it was greater than statistical, the way that they were able to observe and the way that people reported these experiences. It seemed to be a greater than statistical occurrence, the so-called psychic phenomena. So at the end of the day, I mean, all I can really say about that is, again, you can pretend it never happened. You can rewrite history all you want to. You can say that there's no science that supports something like psychic phenomena. But it is something that has been studied more than just, you know, little ESP meetings in people's basements or at little conferences. It's more than just a fringe idea. It's something that our government has put money behind, and at very least there seem to have been certain tangible results. And avoiding that doesn't make it go away. I think if we want to understand human consciousness and we want to understand the workings of the mind, we have to at times, whilst being skeptical, of course, at least approach those subjects, explore what people who have had those experiences have to say, and make determinations that are indeed based on science. Maybe one day science will teach us new things about those things which we call unexplained today. I don't think they'll remain that way in the future. That'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. Thank you, Habbo, and thank you, Mr. Matthew Oakley, as always, for joining me here on the program. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, Tiffany Mack, and the lovely assistant Lauren, I am your host, Micah Hanks, and I bid you adieu. Until next time, my friends, as always, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.